Hi, this is Joe Patty. Thanks for listening to WRTI Online. This service is made possible through the support of WRTI's members. You can become a member, too. Since you're already online, just visit www.wrti.org and click the Become a Member link on the upper left corner of the webpage. You can also join us by phone at 1-866-809-9784. Your membership will help keep WRTI's broadcast and online services strong. And again, thank you. Now, on with the show.
The glorious strains of solo cello here in our studios, being played by Matt Heimovitz. Welcome once again to Crossover, Matt.
Thanks. It's great to be back with you.
What was that you were playing?
That was Gheorghe Ligeti's, the very beginning of his solo sonata.
Now, have you recorded that as yet?
I did. I have recorded it twice, actually. It's on my new release, Goulash. And in fact, I ended up making the first recording of this piece in the early 90s for Deutsche Grammophone. I only had 3 days with the piece, and I was in the midst of recording a solo album in the outskirts of Salzburg, wonderful, very beautiful church. And just published that week was Gheorghe Ligeti's early sonata from the late 40s, early 50s. And I was so excited. We finished recording early, and I decided to read through it for the mics. And unbeknownst to me, the recording team had the tapes running, and they sent him, they shipped Maestro Ligeti this tape of me reading through his sonata. And he called a day later. We were actually already swimming in the pond because we were done. I thought I was done with the recording, and he phoned, and I couldn't believe it. And I started asking him, you know, having this living composer there, I started asking him immediately all kinds of questions about the piece. Am I playing it in the right tempo? You know, dynamics, and is this what you intended? And he said, look, I really want you to make a recording of this piece, but I don't discuss music over the phone. So if you're interested, you have to fly to Hamburg. We'll work for a few hours, and then you fly back to Salzburg and record and finish the recording. So that's what I did. And it was one of these life-changing artistic moments for me, where just working directly with a composer of that intellect and heart. This was in 91, I think, 1991, something like that. And just extraordinary experience. He knew what he wanted with every note of
now,
this piece.
Now, does he understand the instrument? Does he play it at all? I mean, I often wonder about composers who write for instruments, and if they are musicians themselves playing that instrument,
right.
Of course, it's much different.
It is. It's a very good question. I mean, in some sense, I almost prefer composers who aren't that familiar with the instrument, because I like how they imagine possibilities that I would never even come to. I remember there was one moment in our working in Hamburg that I asked Mr. Ligeti, how is this possible? This is so hard. This passage, I think it was something in the fast movement, something like that, that kind of leaps up into the high register, and I asked him, how do you do that? That's impossible. And he said, just practice.
Well, you know, I think they're very intolerant. You know, composers say, I want it that way, do it however you have to do it.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's that actually was a big lesson for me, that to give the composer the benefit of the doubt. If it's in their imagination, there's got to be some way to make
and
it work.
And probably that's a discovery for you as well, because you as the cellist, you as the master of the instrument, think in a certain way, but for someone who is creating and doesn't really know the intricacies, the technical difficulties, they know they just want this.
Right.
And so for you, again, it's a discovery on how to produce this for them.
Exactly.
So now you have, what kind of audience reaction do you get when you play this? I mean, Ligeti is actually, you hear his name and people kind of roll their eyes, but some of his work is fascinating.
In 50 years, they won't. In 50 years, he'll be considered like Beethoven and Brahms and all the greats. I mean, he is consistently, he's produced groundbreaking music, absolutely beautiful music too. I mean, I just played his first string quartet, which was composed only a year after the Sola Sonata. And actually, when I play the Sola Sonata, everybody's very surprised. It's an early work that's really more influenced by Bartok.
Accessible, a little bit more. It's very accessible.
I mean, it has the folk, the Hungarian folk roots in the opening. It's really a love song. The opening. He's this slow what I just played to open the show, and the virtuosity of the second movement. I mean, it's like Paganini or something like that. So it's extremely, and people are surprised. They're like, oh, I thought that was going to be harder.
Yes, well, that's why I'm asking. Yeah,
I think, you know, people are just often just scared of something mm-hmm. new, and the idea of contemporary music can be just conjuring it up is it can be a turnoff for certain audiences, but there's like every genre, there's great music in being written today, and then there's also, you know, less interesting music, but Ligeti is really consistently some of the greatest music being written.
Now, you have constantly, I mean, of course, you do your fabulous classical repertoire, but you are consistently surprising audiences with creating your new albums and the thrust of them, which is really kind of interesting. It's a combination of, well, I guess you kind of stick something in that they can justify, you know, because they know, but then you do something and you just throw a curve. How long have you been doing that? I think that anthem album that you did was also something like that. And of course, you're playing in coffee houses, which was a whole new take on classical performance, was also rather groundbreaking. What started all this?
Well, in terms of these recordings that I'm with Anthem and Goulash, you know, I don't listen to music thinking of categories and only listen to one genre of music, and I suspect that there is an audience, a big audience out there that actually now with iPods and downloading music, and music is just everywhere around you. You listen to different kinds of music at different times, and my an album like Goulash reflects that. I mean, it instead of trying to fit into the straitjacket of just one genre, I kind of use Bartok as a starting point, Béla Bartok, as an inspiration, and Béla Bartok and composers of the past, beginning with Bach, let's say, I mean, these were some of the greatest improvisers of their time. We've kind of lost that tradition to some extent in classical music, but so I don't see why I shouldn't go back and do some improvisation with DJ Olive, we're using Bartok archival material out in the field where he would go and.
You know what was interesting? I had found out that Bartok was very heavily influenced by Debussy. Believe it or not. Yeah, he was introduced to him, I think, his music by Kodály. So it was rather very, you know, interesting that, and you hear it. Actually, in the Romanian and the Hungarian folk songs, and of course,
I think what Bartok did that veered away from Debussy, Debussy was again a groundbreaking mm-hmm. 20th century composer who created extraordinary colors and just a richness of textures
and tonalities,
taking something as simple as, you know, parallel fifths, which aren't allowed in Bach chorale, let's say, he would take them and actually create a form out of this and sort of show that you could, that there's an exception to this rule. But Bartok really, for me, what defines him is the moment when he started to absorb folk culture. He was the first ethnomusicologist with Kodály and went out into the field, meticulously documented these folk cultures in Romania, Hungary, Turkey. He had a really international view. Even in the States, when he came to visit on tour, he was fascinated with the folk culture here, and incorporated this into his compositional process. It's something that Debussy did a little bit of, and he was very intrigued by Eastern mm-hmm. cultures mm-hmm. and so
but
on,
but
not as systematically as Bartok. And that, to me, is where I'm inspired by him. And I think partly having played in a lot of these folk venues and rock and roll clubs, here is a composer that really belongs there to some extent because he incorporates his folk culture.
Do you find the younger audience more accepting of new sound than the older?
Oh, yeah. They're accepting
of anything. They're really much
more
open-minded.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And not just the young audience. There is an audience that's really open to experimentation, to adventure in music, and they're looking for something with more substance. You look at one of my audiences, it's very, very broad, very, very diverse audience.
So now you have a tune by Led Zeppelin on this new Goulash album, which tell us a little bit about that.
Well, that's Kashmir. It's actually, I chose it because it is in a Turkish mode that kind of relates to the kind of Turkish, Hungarian, Romanian connection. A lot of the music that Bartok was hearing in Romania and Hungary came from Turkey, and he realized that later on, and actually went to Turkey, visited, he wanted to spend more time. He only spent two weeks there, but we improvised, in fact, on two Turkish tunes that he discovered there, with Constantinople, a wonderful group from Montreal. But this Kashmir, really, so I chose it for the Turkish theme, but I don't know why they called it Kashmir. It should be Istanbul or something like that. But what's nice about Kashmir is that it's one of these places in the world that's really, I think of it as a kind of very contested area between Pakistan and India. This border, very, very ambiguous borders. Mm-hmm. And same thing with Transylvania, where all these composers are from, Bartok, Ligeti, Kurtag. Transylvania is this area that now belongs to Romania. Many Hungarians live there, and it's been tossed around. I mean, really fought over for years, and brings out tremendous emotion in the people of this region, similar to the Israel-Palestine
idea.
Well,
you answered my question because you were born in Israel, right?
Yeah.
And of course, for some reason, I think there's that Middle Eastern music that you hear, and I feel that very, very much in this particular album, Goulash. I mean,
it's definitely very autobiographical. I mean, there's no question. Anthem was to some extent too, but Goulash is really. I started to really feel the connections of my parents and grandparents are from Romania. I was born in Israel. And hearing some of these Middle Eastern influences in the folk cultures of Romania and Hungary I could very much relate to. So it definitely must be in the blood, I guess.
Are the scales the same? There's something. I mean, you do a lot of. Well, of course, the sliding. I know in not just your playing, but actually even in. I guess it's the sitar, the Indians.
Right, exactly. We have a sitar actually on the album on
you
Goulash.
Do. Yeah. Well, of course, that's that endless note, as it were.
Right.
You know, Ligeti, does he use that as well, or did you figure
well,
it that
he,
way?
Well, he does to some extent. I mean, because he's using like in the second movement, he's using the pentatonic.
Yes, the five tone.
The five tone scale. Which actually came. It's funny if you listen closely to the end of the second movement of the Ligeti, this fast movement, you hear actually an allusion to gamelan music. That's what he was hearing. He had LPs of gamelan, and it kind of breaks down. In fact, it's a scale like this, something like that, and then it just actually breaks down.
Chromatic.
And then finally starts up again. But he's basically taking that and, like a kaleidoscope, transforming this pentatonic scale into something that actually sounds more Hungarian.
Right.
And so he's drawing the connection between gamelan and Hungarian folk music. But all these composers, I mean, these composers, that's what they were. Bartok started that.
It's almost like taking a safari, you know, as you're going through the different countries, you're bringing along this previous information and kind of changing it with other components. And you really feel that. You feel that musically. I think it's a journey that you take.
Exactly.
And then you kind of arrive somewhere and you say, well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
And exactly. Of course, that, of course, is yeah. what happens with music in general. But right. when you're getting away from the very tonal, accessible thing that we're so used to hearing right. and opening up your mind right. and your ear to this new sound, which is not very new. I mean, this happened in the early part of the 20th century.
Right. Well, so. That's why I call it goulash, because I think
smells
and tastes
delicious.
conjure up this journey almost in a very quick way.
So, what are your how do you feel? Do you clear your palate when you play the Bach unaccompanied suites?
I don't think of them as clearing, but they're so substantive that they're beyond clearing palates. But it is interesting when you play a program of Ligeti and Adrian Pop and or with DJ Olive and so on, and then you play all of a sudden you just play a Bach movement from Bach or a whole suite. There is a sign of recognition and in the audience especially that there's something that it puts you at a certain piece and
it takes you to a different place. But you, as a musician, I mean, when you're playing music, standard repertoire, let's put it that way, have you done much of that now? Are you concentrating more on the, I don't want to use the word experimental, but you're really going into the nether regions of music.
I guess my perspective is that Bach is as experimental and new as anything else I play, and I play Bach suites. For me, playing Dvorak Cello Concerto, that is the quintessential American concerto. It's the piece that he wrote when he was here, longing for his homeland. It incorporates even folk themes from America in it, and Beethoven's sonatas. Beethoven put the cello on the map, with the cello and piano sonatas, and I wrote my thesis on the last sonata of Beethoven, Opus 1, 2, number 2. So I'm immersed in the classics and in what we call standard repertoire. But for me, it's hearing it in context and perspective. When you hear Ligeti, and then you hear a Bach suite,
yes,
you suddenly realize not only how familiar the Bach is, but actually how new it is too. How in the preludes, Bach is improvising. You know, and creating this large narrative over 25 minutes or 30 minutes to actually hold the attention of the listener for that amount of time and integrate all of these ideas on a solo, single-voiced instrument. It's really, really extraordinary.
Bach was, of course, inhibited. I mean, his frame of reference was really defined, whereas as we go into the more contemporary music, they are allowed to explore. Not that people accept it, but the boundaries have been extended. I mean,
the language is developed. I mean, it's just like we don't speak today like Shakespeare wrote. It's the same thing, but we still can appreciate what Shakespeare did with the language, and it's affected how we speak today. But it's the same kind of thing, that it's a different intelligibility. I can't even say that word. In terms of our frame of reference, we have a tonal. There's a tonal root to music in general. I mean, just the fundamental. You look at the fundamental overtone series, and I love what Bernstein, in that book, the Unanswered Question. He asked, "I don't know what the question is, but the answer is yes." And that's exactly mm-hmm. Tonality exists. It is fundamental to our existence. We feel it and breathe it, and it is intrinsic to that fundamental overtone series. However, it produces all these different pitches and microtones and so on. And you have Indian music incorporating the microtones and other Middle Eastern music. So it's so rich. And it's just a matter of opening our own ears and minds to the different experiences and the different languages.
So who then makes the rules? We don't have the same rules.
Boy, the rules, yeah. For me, a piece of music makes its own rules, each piece of music. And I think Bach did this with every piece he wrote, mm-hmm. for every combination of instruments. Haydn did this with churning out a new string quartet every week and kind of blowing us away with the different textures and forms. Ligeti does this with every new piece that he writes. Great composers do this. They work within the parameters of that piece, and that piece requires a certain solution, a certain resolution, and working out of the ideas. And Schoenberg, or you know, or some atonal composer or serial composer, Milton Babbitt, will do that with different rules, different parameters. But they do it. They can do it successfully. And for me, it's up to the performer to sell that piece, to make it work.
I was just going to say, and how lucky they are to have great artists like you playing their music. And we're so lucky to have had you here today, Matt.
Thank you so much.
Wonderful new album, Goulash. And let us know how you're doing with it.
Thank you. I will. Thanks a lot for having me.
It's Osvaldo Golijov. Oración Lucumi, is that
it? Lucumi.
Lucumi.
It's an African Lucumi.
Oh, okay.
And John McLaughlin, who is really one of my musical heroes, talk about an improviser.
Unbelievable.
I mean, the guy can't play a wrong note.
He is phenomenal.
He is.
Jazz and classical.
Exactly, exactly. I mean, and fusion. I mean, he's sort of one of the fathers of jazz fusion. He was so generous to... He asked me, actually, to join him for his album last year, Thieves and Poets, and
yes.
I called him up kind of sheepishly, actually. I didn't think he would take me up on it, and he said, you know, you played on my band last year, I'll play on your band this year, and join me for this. I play all six cello parts. Osvaldo actually asked for that, the composer. We could have had you cello playing all the parts, but he kind of wanted that slightly ambiguous texture of the six parts.
Recorded the separate tracks.
I recorded the separate tracks. I'm crickets, actually. I'm like crickets in the night.
Uh-huh.
And John plays Osvaldo's tune, but also he came back and actually improvised on it. And he said, you don't have to use the improvisations. You know, you can just play it straight however you like. I was like, are you kidding?
I had tried to get in touch with him with that album that he had made, but it was really impossible. I'll just
he's tough. Unless he's on tough. Tour, it's tough mm-hmm. to get a hold of him.
Yeah.
But just what a generous spirit, and one of these people where the person is reflected in the music and vice versa. You can hear in his music what a larger than life human being he is. And it's a thrill to have him on the album.
Well, Matt, I don't think he would have approached you if he didn't feel that you were the same. So
That's nice. Thank you.
Anyway, okay, so that's good. Anything else we have to talk about? I guess this Constantinople. Let's just a quick
Constantinople. They're a how do I describe them? They play mostly Middle Eastern kind of Baroque instruments, sitar, oud. We have Baroque flute in the ensemble, and percussion and a old, kind of not viola da gamba, but a vie, a smaller form of viola da gamba. And, they're up in Montreal, and they do a lot of, Baroque Renaissance music, but they also improvise. One of these rare ensembles that does both contemporary and older music, and so I thought we might click, and we did. We just took these two Turkish tunes, and in one day in the recording studio just worked up a kind of form. We improvised to them. There's an introduction which is very much improvised, and it leads into kind of a more dance movement, a Turkish dance movement that's really more of an arrangement, but we left windows of opportunity to improvise in there, and you definitely hear a very Middle Eastern texture to it. It's a tapestry of sorts.
Is there a difference between the jazz improvisation that we hear and classical improvisation? Because I know that most classical musicians find it very difficult to improvise.
Oh, yeah.
Probably because of the training, which is
exactly. We're
very
so used
rigid.
To the score.
Yeah.
We're very, mm-hmm. very reluctant to,
right.
to leave the score.
So
we don't know what to do. We're like deer
yes.
in a headlight.
I remember, I think it was Itzhak Perlman was asked to improvise something. It was the klezmer music and so
oh,
on.
Yes.
And he was okay, but he was really not at all comfortable. How does one kind of break through that barrier as a classical musician?
You just, well, you just throw yourself over the cliff and do it, and you learn. It's you learn by doing, and it's, you know, some. It's funny because I was having breakfast recently with John McLaughlin, and I made the comment. I said, you know, it's so nice in improvisation, there are no wrong notes. You if you play a wrong note, you have to work yourself out of it. And he said, no, that's not the way it works. There are wrong notes in improvisation. And
a
master like that, you get to the point where you can anticipate exactly what you want and what you're contributing and how you're building a form and with me, I'm still at the stage of learning, experimenting, every night when I do this, and I did this with DJ Olive, I went to Texas for 4 shows, and I decided that the entire show I would just improvise. And this is from someone coming from a very classical upbringing,
very. Mm-hmm.
with no real jazz background or improvisation background. And I wanted to run away that first show. I didn't want to go on a stage. It was like when I was 10 years old, you know, they had to push me on stage, mm-hmm. that kind of feeling. But once you start doing it, you start to really listen in a way that is very intense, very intimate. You start to feel a certain chemistry, and if you give yourself the freedom and you open your ears to that, you just start exploring, and over time. I feel like I'm a much better improviser now than I was 2 years, 3 years ago.
Well, I would think, generally to improvise in a more traditional manner in classical is understandable, but to go into a completely different genre, I mean, it's a whole other world that you're going into if this Middle Eastern music,
right.
as you want to say, then there must be gimmicks. I bet they have gimmicks, though, some of the improvisers.
Yeah.
They do,
but... you know, I went on tour last year with Charlie Hunter and Bobby Previtt and some of these more kind of hardcore jazz guys, and I noticed we did a 10-city tour by bus actually with 20 musicians. We were all doing our thing, and then we improvised with each other through the course of the evening. It was kind of a marathon improvisation evening, and I noticed that. Out of the 10, 2 of the shows were absolutely transcendent. Mm-hmm. They just, and those were the 2 shows where they didn't rely on any of their standard gimmicks or what they can do
certain,
with these, some of their trademark formulas.
Right.
They really went off and just were as vulnerable as they could be. You know, they just went out on the cliff. And sometimes
that happens anyway.
Yeah.
I think you're probably, it's the chemistry.
Yeah.
It has a lot to do with that. It's like speaking to people, I think,
right.
that you sometimes you just can't, and then there's
right.
sometimes it just works.
Right.
And probably when you're on that level, it's a rarefied world that
exactly.
you're in, but it's probably the most exhilarating
that's
experience.
It is absolutely have. I mean it's the essence of creation, you know. It's just you live in that moment. It doesn't happen all the time, and like I said, on a 10-city tour I thought it happened maybe twice.
Now what were you doing with jazz artists? Were you playing jazz?
No, I was, well, they got me playing jazz later in the tour. at a certain point, I was like, okay, I'll do anything. I started off each show with Bach and then played, you know, David Sanford's Seventh Avenue Kaddish, which is inspired by John Coltrane and Walter Golihov and Hendrix, Star Spangled Banner and so on. And then every night I wouldn't know who would kind of come up to the stage with me and just start jamming.
Mm-hmm.
And early on in the tour, DJ Olive came up. That's how I met him, actually.
I see.
And he came up and played on stage. As I was playing the Hendrix, all of a sudden I started hearing Hendrix's own guitar sound behind me, like kind of in you know, jamming to me. And I turned my head, and there was DJ Olive, and I thought, oh, this is kind of cool. And you know, so we're jamming for 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden it was getting louder and louder, and the texture was thickening, and I turn over and there's Charlie Hunter, and then all of a sudden, you know, I turn around and there's Bobby Previn. So, you know, we without stopping, you know, no just continuous transition, one musician after another came on stage. Then I got tired, I left the stage, and they continued. And there was, you know, there was jazz ensemble who got me to do a jazz number with them in Chicago, actually. And I said, but I don't do jazz. And he said, oh, you'll know what to do, you know. And
don't
so
you
we,
love when they say that?
So I sat there and Stephen Bernstein, you know, or kind of arranging on stage. He has this really wonderful way of kind of inspiring people on stage and kind of and shutting them up also, if you want, you know, just kind of live arranging. And so started off really loud and started grooving, and then brings everybody to kind of a quiet brewing moment. And then he just points to me, and I look at him like, you know,
what
are you talking about? And he just whispers to my ear, you know, this is live for, you know, whatever, 1,000-1,500 people in a rock and roll club in Chicago, screaming kids and so on, dancing up and down, and everybody's kind of like just waiting to see what I'm gonna do.
So were
says,
you.
And he whispers in my ear, you know, oh, you know, staccato, legato, whatever you want.
Oh,
you
my
know, a couple
goodness.
Of classical terms. And I just started, he was right. I mean, it just became inevitable. You know, you listen to the harmony, you listen to the rhythm,
you realize, you know, that you have just discussed your next album.
Oh, okay, thank you. I was wondering where that idea
was
going to come from.
That's right. That's the idea for it. And we'll hold you to it, Matt.
Sounds
wonderful.
Good.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.